first.
So in your recent blog post, you express a great deal of concern about ethical practice in forensic psychology. What are some of your major concerns in this area, and how did you come to have those concerns?
I became concerned when I saw how some forensic psychologists were behaving in court and also in their reports, in their written reports, advancing theories and facts that I didn't think had much support. And the problem with that is that oftentimes the judges and attorneys and juries don't have the training, education to know what's real and what's not. And so these practices can go unchecked if there's not somebody on the other side, for example, saying, wait a minute, this doesn't sound right. Where's the evidence base for what you're claiming? So that was kind of what prompted me to, one of the things that prompted me to start my blog.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the specific areas that I've blogged a lot about had to do with psychiatric diagnosis, mm-hmm. and kind of these, what I call pseudo-diagnoses that get advanced in court just to further a certain agenda, and they're not really real and they don't really have much to do with the legal issues. So that's something that I've blogged about a lot, but it just has to do with the general ethics of making sure that we go into courts, high-stakes situations, and that we're not going further than the science would support.
Mm-hmm. Can I deviate and ask a question about that?
Yes.
Is that all right?
Sure.
I'm just thinking, like, I'm not too sure about how it is over in the States, but do you think that there needs to be a regulatory body that can actually enforce these things to happen? So say, well, that's technically not a real diagnosis, or you didn't have enough evidence, or...
Well, that's a really good question, and I am sort of struggling with that issue myself, because on the one hand, I think that might be what's needed, and certainly some people are calling for that, because all of the standards in our field are mostly aspirational, they're not binding, and so, you know, all the people who are really ethical follow them, and the people who are not, or maybe they're a little bit lazy, they just don't. And so maybe if there was some kind of authority to make it mandatory, that might help. On the other hand, those types of authority things tend to limit access to the courts for underprivileged people, you know, in practice. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. I think it might be helpful, but it might also be used. You know, there's always some unintended consequences of things. So I try to think out down the line, would that really work, or would people get around it and it would end up working in a way that it wasn't intended?
Yeah.
I think your the new practice in Australia of what they call hot tubbing is kind of interesting. You know, where experts from our point are, I guess, retained on different sides and come together and talk about the case and try to come to some sort of middle ground that makes sense, and then present that to the court. I think that might be an interesting approach, and I think it's starting to spread. I think you guys are exporting it to a little bit to Canada and Europe and the United States. So I haven't looked into it in that great depth, but I'm planning to blog about it soon.
Okay.
We'll wait to hear what you have to say on it.
Okay, thank you. You've written quite extensively on the limitations of sex offender risk assessment tools currently being used in the legal system, as well as the importance of encouraging forensic students to engage in critical thinking when learning to write court reports. What additional advice would you give to budding forensic psychologists who may be considering conducting sex offender risk assessments in the near future?
A couple things. One is really know the critical literature on the limits of the science. So it's too easy to pick up a risk assessment instrument and use it on somebody and think, okay, now I've got my answer. But if you really look at the critical literature, those instruments aren't all that predictive, and they have really high false positive rates, which makes them very dangerous. So, for example, if a person is predicted to be high risk for violence on an actuarial instrument, the chances are 6 out of 10 that that's a false positive. So 6 out of 10 of the people that you put that on wouldn't have become dangerously violent. That's kind of a scary statistic. So Jay Singh, S-I-N-G-H, is a scholar, sort of an international scholar these days. He's all over the world, but he's done some of the critical meta-analyses in these areas, so I would encourage people to read his work in particular. And then the other thing is just to be aware of your own biases, and that's kind of hard to do, but to try to, as much as possible, take steps to kind of counteract your own biases, like instead of just wading into an evaluation, think about competing hypotheses and testing them. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of a way of limiting one's biases, because one more apt to look at different angles to do that. So those are two things I would suggest.
And your blog has become very popular with forensic experts around the globe. What are some of the advantages of blogging on current issues? And do you experience any negative consequences for being so vocal on current social justice and human rights issues?
This is a really good question. Some of the advantages are that it gives me an outlet to express my opinion and hopefully influence the field or the fields. So most of my readers are forensic psychologists as well as students and also attorneys and professors. So, and it's international audience, so I'm hoping that having a critical voice out there has some modest influence. It's also why I'm here in Australia, actually. It was because the criminologist Paul Wilson was following my blog and invited me to give a keynote talk 2 years ago at a forensic psychology national conference, and from there that's when I'm invited here. So it's been really nice in terms of networking and just branching out. But yes, there are some definite negative consequences. Because I have so many posts on so many topics, it's just fodder for attorneys who are trying to, you know, accuse me of bias on the witness stand, you know, during cross-examination. And so, like, just the week before I came here, this happened to me where an attorney had just went to my website and looked at my blog and downloaded a handful of different posts and just read from them very selectively.
Context.
You know, yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so just to try to portray me as not supporting the sexually violent predator laws, which that was what the case was. So, yeah, I'm kind of opening myself up there, kind of putting a bullseye on my body by blogging, but I to me it's worth it. On balance, it's worth it.
I suppose it also might give you the opportunity to explain what you mean in a context where most of the people in the room wouldn't have read your blog. So they're bringing up this sentence or this little bit, and you can say, well, actually what I meant was, and what I was talking about is, and then a whole bunch of more people are hearing what you've got to say in the courtroom instead of online.
That could happen. That would be the idea, the hope, yeah.
Yeah,
if the judge allowed it.
Yeah.
And if they didn't shut me down.
Okay, so with such a busy workload, how do you maintain a healthy work-life balance, and what self-care practices do you engage in?
Another nice question. What I try to do, because I am just really frenetically busy all the time, is set time limits on my work and, like, not work weekends or evenings, if at all possible. Kind of have a regular schedule and have family time that's, you know, set aside where I don't think about work. And just I try to exercise regularly. I think that's really important. I would like to meditate, but maybe my walking is walking and meditation, because I think that's really important to clear one's mind, you know, and not think about work.
Yeah.
And just doing other hobbies that I find entertaining, reading for pleasure, going to the movies,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Thanks. And what have been some of the most rewarding moments in your career so far?
Well, actually coming here to Australia twice now has been among the more rewarding moments, and also the UK. I was invited to come to England and London as part of a consortium looking at a multiple perpetrator rape, also known as gang rape. Trying to come up with some international intervention strategies, that was really rewarding. So these two international venues have been extremely rewarding. On a day-to-day basis, I'd say what's most rewarding is when I put a lot of effort into a case and then it has a positive outcome, or what I consider to be a positive outcome. For example, of righting a wrong, when I feel like somebody really has been a victim of a miscarriage of justice and I can make a compelling case for why that is, and then that actually works out.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy that.
Fantastic. So if you could go back in time, what advice would you give yourself at the beginning of your career?
That's a hard question. You know, it's really a hard question. Because you have to go through what you go through in order to get to where you are, right?
Yeah.
It's all about the stages of development, professional development. I might say keep a journal, just so that I could reflect back, and it's memory is fallible, right? And so that if I had a journal, I'd be able to look back and look at what the circumstances I was going through as this progression
mm-hmm.
takes place. I guess I would also give myself the advice to really remain critical of everything that I am told, not take anything at face value, which is kind of the way I am anyway, but it's easy for, like, at a student level or even a postdoctoral level to kind of be listening to somebody and just believing what they're saying and not really taking into account that it's just one perspective and that there are
mm-hmm.
other perspectives.
Yep.
So I think that would be a couple things.
Mm. I like the journal idea.
Yeah, yeah. Do we
start now?
Yeah.
You never know.
And how do you remain so prolific in writing, given your schedule?
One thing that helps is I have a background in journalism. That's my original undergraduate training. I was attended journalism school and then worked as a daily newspaper reporter for about 5 years. And so in daily newspaper journalism, you have deadlines, right? And you have to make your deadline. So at 4 o'clock, you have to turn in your story. You can't claim that you're busy or got caught up on something else or you had writer's block. So that has been helpful to me in just being able to write quickly. And I am something of a workaholic, so just that motivates me. And there's a sense of pressure from the subscriber base for the blog, for example, because the larger it gets, and some of the subscribers actually pay to subscribe, even though that's just voluntary. The larger it gets, that puts pressure on me that I have to keep writing because they're expecting something.
Yeah.
Okay. So what tricks of the trade can you share with us that have enhanced your professional practice, be it in interviewing, note-taking, or building assessment, or report writing?
I would say it's really hard to come up with one thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm giving a talk. You guys are welcome if you're free. And 45 minutes.
Yes, we'll be there.
Yeah, I can edit this part out, but yeah, I mean, it's going to be more answer to this question. But I would say, like I said, it's hard to boil it down to one or two things. But I would say really making a conscious effort not to put people in a box and not to think of the person that you're evaluating as different in some way, like as a certain type of person, but rather always try to maintain that sense of kind of connection and compassion, that they're a human being too. They may, you know, may have gone down a very different path in life than you did, but there's still basic human similarities, and trying not to be judgmental of the person, even though you're judging maybe the bad act that got committed. Trying to just think about putting yourself in their shoes and trying to walk a mile in their shoes, and how would that be? That's been really, really helpful, that approach, because, I mean, for one thing, it helps with understanding, but it also helps the other person feel like you're listening to them and can hear them, so it helps with the connection and rapport, which is, I think, what the question asks about, yeah.
Yes.
That would be my most important point, I think.
Okay.
And then that last question that we don't know what it is.
Yeah. I think you sort of answered it in a few of the other questions anyway.
Well, I have a couple, if you want to ask it as something along the lines of, you know, tips for how would we word that? Just tips for students, I guess, launching their career, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that will be very relevant for some of the people that will be coming today to your talk as well.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. And I don't want to. What do you call it when you spoil the mystery? But yeah, so I'll answer that question that I just posed. I would say really focus on writing skills and making sure that your writing skills are really good, because your written word is your main product in this field. And so, you know, take the time to learn how to write well, read a lot, and also publish. I don't know about you all, but a lot of students in the States are really afraid of publishing and think that it's a lot harder than it is, and it's not really that hard, because you're writing anyway. You're writing your dissertations, your theses, etc., and it's not that hard to winnow them down into a publishable form. There's so many journals out there. So I think that really enhances status to have publications.
Yeah.
So those are just a few of my suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think
those are all the questions.
Oh, good. We got through those in a very rapid fire way.
Yeah. Right? We did.
Well, it'll be pretty long when it's written out, too, so I'm sure it'll be as much space as you want for your journal, for your newspaper, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the magazine.
Magazine?
Yep.
I feel like I have so many more questions that I want to ask. I don't know if it'll be used for the journal or magazine, but I don't know if you have the time or the...
You can ask another one or two if you have.
Do you think that's a...
Yeah, go for it.
Do you have any other questions that you want to...
I think most of it Karen will be covering in her talk, so...
Yeah, I suppose I could save it for then.
Yeah, that'd be good too, then somebody will ask questions, although I imagine people will ask questions there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you have a burning question, feel free.
Well, I originally wrote many, many questions, and then, you know, but I'm a very keen follower of your blog, and every time I read something, I have another question I'm thinking about, and I find it really inspiring as a fresh psychologist to read that critical review, like what you were talking about. And I was thinking about how when you say you're a forensic psychologist and people say, oh, well, what's that? What does it mean? You say, well, I work with people in the legal system, and eventually get to the point where you say, you know, I might work with violent offenders or sex offenders or something like that. And the response is, well, how can you work with people like that? Or, you know, what, so you help pedophiles, or, you know, that sort of approach where some people in the public take that really like hard line, they box people and they judge them for their actions. How do you respond to that internally, but also to other people that might be quite critical of that?
That's a really good question. In fact, there's a book by a defense attorney. The title of the book is How Can You Defend Those People? Because he got that so much.
Yeah.
It's an old book. Yeah. But that's the question. And what I say to people is that I'm not trying to excuse bad behavior, but I do think it's important to understand it. And if we just condemn people and don't really understand, then we're not helping to prevent future bad behavior from happening. And I also really do firmly believe that even people who have done really bad things are not just that, you know, that they have another side to them, and that most people can be salvaged given the proper approach and resources, which is not the way, at least in my country, that's definitely not the way, the common outlook. It's very punitive. So, I get exactly what you're saying. I think it's just to remind ourselves that we're trying to understand and we're trying to explain.
And I think that sort of goes back to what you were saying earlier about separating the person from the behavior as well, and looking at it that way.
It's also, I think, really important to sit back and think that, or get other people to think that if people are going to go to prison, most likely, unless they have a life sentence, which here it's 25 years, so
it is in life. Here you can usually get out.
They're going to get out, which means that they're going to have to reintegrate back into society eventually. So if we don't understand it, and if we don't work with it, and, you know, treat it and help, and then we're not preventing anything from happening.
That's probably a really good way to put it to people, I think, in your situation, that people are going to be getting out because, they could either be better or worse when they get out. What do you want? Do you really want to? I mean, in the United States, things are so sort of bizarre. You know, the criminal justice system, they just lock people up, and then people do get out after being, say, in solitary confinement for years, and they're totally berserk, you know, and they go berserk and they hurt people, and it's like, well, you should have been able to see that coming, you know. So, well, I'm glad to hear that you are a follower of the blog. That's great.
Subscribe.
I talk to people like you, and then I think, oh God, I got to write more. I haven't been writing much because I've been so busy getting ready to come to this, and I'm doing a talk in Hawaii as soon as I leave here too. So I've been really busy and trying to do the, what is it, part
self-care.
Number four, self-care as well, like taking lots of walks on the beach while I've been here, and but cycling down to the national park.
Down in Burley?
Yeah,
it's so nice.
Cycle
down
from
there.
Broad Beach to there.
Yeah,
it's really nice. Yeah, so that's the thing that competes with the blogging, doing other things.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm reading it, I forget that blogging is like not your, like it's a part of your work.
It's not
but
my.
So many other things.
I know. That's sort of my extra thing. So that's the problem, is that, you know, because I do teach and then teach and do my casework that pays the bills, and then the blogging is an add-on.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us.
Well, I'm glad you found me.
Yes. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I figured you guys were